nanohub.org. You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so this is ECE 659, and I think the official title of the course is Quantum Transport. And broadly speaking, what it is about is this field of nanoelectronics that you've heard of. Now, in nanoelectronics, of course, if you ask, like, what is the most common device that you might want to learn about, what's the one that's, like, by far the most numerous? And the answer would be, I think, a field effect transistor. And the reason is that I think everyone in this room, we all probably have a laptop. And every one of those laptops has about 1 billion field effect transistors in it. So the people in this room, I think we kind of collectively own about 50 billion transistors. Okay? So that tells you the number we are talking about here. And what a transistor basically looks like is, you see, basically it's a resistor whose resistance can be controlled. So resistor meaning you have something you call the channel, that's the whose resistance you are controlling. And the way you measure its resistance is that you have got two contacts. Contacts are very highly conductive relative to the channel, and so the resistance is actually controlled by the channel itself. So I'll call this, put a C there, that's channel, that's one contact, that's the other contact, call S and D, and that's source and drain. And if you want to measure the current through this, you'd usually put a voltage and measure the current. Now that would be a two-terminal device, and that would be just a resistor. Now the way you make it into a transistor is you have a third terminal, one with which you can control the resistance of the channel. And usually, again, this is just a schematic picture. It's not necessarily the way it's laid out in practice. Right? That would be very different from one device to another. But this is just a schematic picture. So here's this channel that's conducting, where electrons go through. And you have some kind of an insulator here, so that electrons ideally cannot flow in this direction. But what you can do is put a potential here and change the condition of the channel. And what we mean by condition will gradually get clear. And by changing the condition of the channel, you can have a different amount of current going through. So you can change the resistance. And so there is this other voltage that you can put on here. And that's also a V. And to distinguish between those two, you usually put a subscript, call that the drain voltage, call that the gate voltage. And using this gate voltage, you control the resistance. And of course, the drain voltage is what drives the current. So that would be the simple schematic of what a field effect transistor looks like. Okay? And this, as I said, is like the most common device. And the questions you could ask is, well, what is this current as a function of voltage? And there, of course, you have got these two voltages. Typically, if I had to draw the current versus, say, the drain voltage, it would look something like, when you apply a voltage here, the current increases. And if you look at the slope of that, that's like what you'd call the resistance. I guess if it's di dv, you'd call it conductance. Inverse would be resistance. And in good transistors, usually what happens is when you put a big enough voltage, and typically these days supply voltages are somewhere between half volt and 1 volt, somewhere in there. So when you put a big enough voltage, it actually wants to level off. Actually, ideally, you'd have liked it to be flat. But in these small devices, usually, it's hard to get it really flat. It actually keeps increasing somewhat, but it does turn over. So the two things you would ask about this is, what's this slope? That's the conductance. What's the current you get, the saturation current? I mean, ideally, it would be saturating. What's that on current? Those are the kinds of questions you would ask. And then, of course, you'd like to know how this current versus voltage characteristic is controlled by the gate. Because what the gate does is it can enhance the current, make it go this, or it can cut it off, make it go like so. That's what a gate would do, change this. And how much change can you get? And typically, the field effect transistors that we have in our laptops, the resistance here can be controlled from, say, about 10 kilo ohms, that's when it's on, to about, say, a mega ohm or so, when it's off. So in the on state, it's a relatively low resistance. It goes to a very high resistance. And that's what you then use this as a switch. Switch that, you know, can go from an off state to an on state. And as I said, there's billions of these switches which, working in concert, do all the interesting things that a computer does. Yeah. So if we were to try to understand how a transistor works, then it would be we'd like to be able to describe this resistance, describe this on current, how a gate voltage changes it, things of this sort. That's what you'd like. Now, in this course, though, in general, we'll not really be getting into the details of any particular device, how it works. And part of the reason is that this whole field is now in a state of flux where it's not quite clear, like 5 years from now, what kind of devices will actually be useful or will be used. And what I talked here about is this transistor, which is like a switch. And as I said, every computer has billions of switches in it, has a billion switches in it. But switch is not the only type of device you're really interested in. There's all kinds of other devices you'd want to know about. For example, one of the most interesting things these days everyone's talking about is energy conversion devices. That is, how can you take, say, waste heat and turn it into electricity, for example. And people say, well, maybe if you could design nanoscale devices, it would help you do things like that. Then there's applications that involve sensing. Because with these small devices, the size of the device is now comparable to bacteria or things of that sort, biological molecules. And the resistance can be affected by the presence or absence of a molecule on the surface, for example. So you could use this to sense the presence or absence of things, etc. So that's, again, another field that's developing. So there's all kinds of other devices. Switches are not everything. This switch is, of course, it's, as I said, the most numerous because every one of us owns a billion of them. But there's many other things, really. And this course is really not about any particular device as such. But it is really more about the principles of it. That is, how do you think about current flow on a very small scale? And this is where, you see, our understanding and the way you think about things has changed enormously, there's been enormous progress in the last 20 years or so. So the kind of things I'm telling you today, it's like 20 years ago or 25 years ago, no one really knew. None of this was at all clear. You see? But there's been a lot of progress, and a lot of progress because there's been lots of very good experiments and theory, and people have, you know, in the last 25 years, a different way of looking at it has emerged, which is what this course is about, which is what we'll really be talking about. See? Now, when you say nanoelectronics, as you know, that word nano, that comes from nanometers. I mean, it's not nanoseconds, for example, because nanoseconds, that's been around for a long time. People make measurements on that scale for a long time. It's really this nanometer scale, because just to get our this length scales clear, then, as you know, there is, I guess, millimeter would be something we all understand. I mean, I could at least point to it. That's about that much. And if you go down by a factor of 1,000, that would be like a micrometer. And if you go down by another factor of 1,000, that would take you to a nanometer. Right? And atomic distances, as you know, all everything's made of atoms. And in a solid, the distance between two atoms is about a tenth of a nanometer, which is called an angstrom. Actually, it's like two or three angstroms, typically. So one angstrom would be like a tenth of that. So that's what you call atomic distances. That's somewhere down here. And so there's a factor of 1,000, another factor of 1,000. And this is the scale on which we normally operate. You know, millimeter is about the smallest scale. Let's see. Okay. And then there's the micrometer. And now, in terms of this resistor, of course, one critical quantity you could define is this length of this active region. That is, length of the channel. Of course, the contacts, although the way I've drawn it, you'd think they're all equal, but actually, in practice, of course, the contact is a big thing relatively. So whatever this length is, those contacts would be like 5 or 10 times that size. But this length of the active region, that tells you what this resistance is actually, how long it is. And that's where, you see, 20, 30 years ago, people were talking of resistors that they were measuring, which was somewhere up here. 10 microns, 1 micron. You know, making something sub-micron was a big deal, real hard. So measurements were all up here. So we're talking of resistors whose length is 10 microns or so. Okay? Whereas these days, every transistor like that, the commercial transistors, the length of the active region is actually less than 0.1 micron. You know, I could look this up. So it's, today's transistors are somewhere here. And if you compare it to the length of an atom, you can see we are talking of channel lengths that are say 500 or 1,000 atoms. That's what we're talking about. That's the length of a commercial transistor, channel in a commercial transistor. That's where we are. And in the laboratory, people can measure things that are down here. People have even measured, they have actually put contacts across a hydrogen molecule. So they can actually measure the resistance of a hydrogen molecule. It's down to that level. See? Whereas, as I said, 25 years ago when I was a graduate student, people are measuring things up here. And one of the things we had kind of talk about is what would really be the resistance of something really small? You know, because one thing you learn here is Ohm's law. People tell you, well, you know, its resistance is proportional to the length divided by the area. That's Ohm's law. There's something called resistivity. And if you turn it around, you can write conductance. Sigma A over L. That's conductivity, that's resistivity. That's the property of the material. Okay? And so people would say, well, what would happen if you made something really small? I mean, would it just continuously go to zero? Because after all, when length is zero, it should go to zero. Then based on this. And it wasn't at all clear. It was, did it really even make sense to talk about the resistance of something really small? Because after all, you know, resistance has something to do with friction, something to do with how heat is generated, for example. You know, I squared R, that's the heat generated. So if you had something so small that there was no friction, electrons just go right through it, would it really have any resistance? So these were all questions. You go back to the 80s, you'll see people arguing about just these issues. What is the resistance of something really small? And the answers were not at all clear then, you see? And by contrast, you see, since 1990 or so, there's been enormous progress. And the reason is that in the early 80s, it was just a philosophical question. And there's no experimental input into this. No one quite knew how to measure anything that small. So measurements were all up here. And you're just having good after-dinner discussions, essentially, about what this would be. And that all changed because around 1988 or so, or 85, is when people started making measurements on things that were really small. and seeing what the answers are and trying to correlate it with what they expected. And that's how gradually things got clearer, which kind of tells you actually how important it is to have good experiments, really, to clear up, to get anywhere in this business. Because you can see all the arguments people were having in those days. And now when you look back and you know the answers in it, you see how it's easy to miss the most important things, or, because there are so many issues involved that you never quite know, which ones are the really important issues, actually. Anyway, so what has happened then in our understanding of current flow is that this whole understanding has progressed in a top-down fashion. Top-down meaning we started with big things, and then we gradually try to understand small things. Okay? And when you do that, what happens is these small things look much more complicated than they need to. And what I believe, and what in this course in general I'll try to show, is that you see, if you take a bottom-up view, which means if you start with something small and then go up, you actually get a much clearer understanding of what's going on, of how to think about current flow in general. See? And these words, you see, this top-down and bottom-up, those are things you'll hear, you'll see a lot in the literature, but it's usually in the context of how to fabricate small things. You see, how to make small resistors. The way you say it is, well, usually the way you make a small resistor is you take a big piece of silicon and chisel out what you want. So that's what you call the top-down approach to making a small thing. And the bottom-up approach would be where you'd have started from molecules and built it up. That's the kind of approach chemists use. So in the context of fabrication, you often hear those words. Okay? But here, of course, I'm using it more in a conceptual sense in terms of how to think about current flow. And that's where I'm saying that because of historical reasons, our entire understanding of resistance is top-down. You start here and you work your way down. Well, now that we know the answers, 25 years ago there was a good reason, because no one knew the answers here. So you start where you know something. But today, since we kind of understand this, it's actually a lot better to look at it the way up. And that's what kind of this course is about. It gives you this understanding of how to think about current flow, how to think about electronic devices in general from this point of view. And just to illustrate what I mean by, how this top-down view works and why it gets confusing, let me just point out that, you see, this conductivity, if you have taken 606 or 305 or any standard course in semiconductor devices, you'd learn that conductivity depends on this number of this electron density and the mobility. That's a product of those two things. That's what you usually write it. You write Q, that's the charge on an electron, electron density, and then something called the mobility, which tells you how easily electrons move around. And this mobility usually is given by Q tau over M, where M is this mass and tau is the mean free time. Right? This you have possibly seen before. The reason I'm not going into it is, as I said, this course is not about this. In fact, what I want to say is that if you start from here, it looks very confusing, and I want to tell you something, a different way of looking at it, which is why I don't want to spend a lot of time explaining where this one came from. But I think you've seen this before. Okay? Now, if you take this point of view, now what's this tau? That's the mean free time. And that comes from the idea that when an electron gets from one end to the other, it doesn't go straight through like this. And in big devices, as you know, electrons kind of get knocked around all over the place as it goes through. So it's like this, like a drunken person trying to get someplace. So it goes this way, etc. So that's the view people have of how an electron gets from one side to the other in big devices. And tau is this mean free time. That's how long does it take before it gets scattered, before it gets turned around. That's the tau. enough. So then if you start from here, what's not clear is what would happen if you made this thing so small that the electron just went straight through. So what exactly is the mean free time then? So that gets confusing to start with. Next thing, you know, what you could do is, instead of using the mean free time, like the scattering time, you could use what's called the transit time. How long does it get from here to there? And as we'll see, under some conditions, if instead of tau you use the transit time, you'd get the right answers, actually. You could make that work. Now, what gets a little more confusing is this mass also. Because what's this mass? You say, well, you know, everyone knows what the mass of an electron is by now. Well, not exactly. That's the effective mass. You see, it's not the free electron mass. Because free electron, as you know, in solids, one of the important insights that people got into the conduction of movement of electrons through solids back in the 1930s and 40s is this concept of effective mass. That an electron, even though a solid is such a complicated object, and an electron goes through it, it acts almost as if it was going through vacuum with a certain effective mass. And where does that come from? Well, that's this, people say there's an EK diagram. There's this EK relationship, which comes from knowing the crystal structure. And if that EK relationship happens to be parabolic, then you could write it as h bar square k square over 2m. And then m is whatever it takes to fit that parabola. So if you're in a particular parabolic band, you can figure out a mass to use. Okay. Now, that, of course, gets to be problematic when you're trying to figure out the current flow through a hydrogen molecule, because you don't even have a periodic solid or an EK diagram or a band structure of anything at all. So it's not clear what to use for mass anyway in such small things. Even otherwise, you run into all kinds of problems when you try to use that. Let's say, for example, these days there's a lot of interest in a material called graphene, which is actually something like graphite, layer of graphite. And it's carbon atoms arranged in this graphite lattice. And the relevant EK relationship here looks something like this, almost linear. So what exactly is the mass of an electron in something like this? Now, what you learn, usually from this point of view, is that given an EK relation, the correct mass to use is defined by the inverse of the mass is given by the curvature of the EK plot. So right, 1 over m is derivative of second derivative of E with respect to k. I think I missed a h bar square apart from that. I think that's the 1 over h bar square, something like that. Okay. Now, if you apply this to something with a EK relationship of this sort, what would you get for the mass? You can see that easily. This is linear. So when you're linear, the curvature is, you know, dE dK is constant, so d2e dK2 is zero. So mass is infinite. So if you took this literally, you'd say, okay, I've got an infinite mass there, so nothing moves, mobility is zero, no current, etc. So you run into trouble right away. So the point I'm trying to make is that this viewpoint, it's really hard to kind of generalize this and take it down to, you know, small devices, different materials and all that. Now, another problem you run into is actually even what is the electron density? Because, again, you'd say, well, in any material you know how many electrons you have. Well, but then that electron density is really not the total number of electrons. It's the number of free electrons, supposedly. So which electrons are free? Because after all, you see, an insulator is not an insulator because it doesn't have electrons. There's lots of electrons. Right? Every solid has just as many positive charges as electrons in it. There's lots of electrons. It's not because of lack of electrons. What they say is that there's lack of free electrons, whatever that is. So when you get down to a hydrogen molecule, well, how many free electrons do you have? Or when you're talking about something a little bigger, which electrons are free, which ones are not? So that's the problem in trying to use an equation like this. You see? Okay. Now, the viewpoint that we will be using, and that's what I'll be developing gradually, this actually will get started next lecture in terms of details. So the bottom-up viewpoint, I'd say, is that when it comes to something really small, the conductance is equal to Q squared over H. And that's the charge on an electron. This is the Planck's constant. And if you put in those numbers, it actually has the dimensions of conductance. And you can try this out. This is conductance and its inverse is resistance. So if you put in those numbers, it's approximately inverse of 25 kiloohms. Approximately. And the conductance is equal to, this is called the quantum of conductance, times pi d gamma. And let me explain what those two things mean. So this D is density of states. Now what do I mean by that? That is, that if you look at this channel, as you know, any material, like if you had a hydrogen atom, you know that it has energy levels that can be occupied by electrons. So any material has a set of energy levels, and the bigger it is, if you think of a big material, the energy levels get more and more densely spaced. So it's more continuous. And with large materials, usually instead of drawing energy levels, it is more convenient to draw this density of states. So what you say is, in a given energy range, how many states do you have? So the units of this would be per electron volt. So because energy in general will generally be using MKS units in this course. MKS unit of energy is joules. But just for energy, it's more convenient to use electron volts. And between the two, as you know, how do you convert joules to electron volts? Well, it's this charge on an electron. So 1.6 times 10 to the power minus 19th joules is equal to 1 electron volt. Now, so the point I was trying to describe here is that the first thing you would like to know about this material is this density of states. So in a given energy range, how many states do you have per electron volt? And you might, in general, have, say, some picture like this, that you have some density of states here, some density of states here. Often in semiconductors, there's a gap. There's a range of energies where there are no states, etc. And usually some of these states are occupied and some of these are empty because you've got these electrons which obey the exclusion principle. So depending on the number of electrons you have in the solid, you'd have to occupy a certain number of states filled. And left to itself, all the lowest ones are occupied, higher ones are not occupied. And the line that divides them, that's called the chemical potential. Sometimes at equilibrium, you call this also the Fermi energy. It's what separates the occupied from the unoccupied. So I'll call that mu. Yeah, I guess I'll use mu for chemical potential a lot. And that will appear many times in what we discuss. And not to be confused with mobility. So if I'm talking about mobility, I'll try to be very specific. So in general, when I'm writing mu, I really mean chemical potential. And at equilibrium, that's also sometimes referred to as the Fermi energy. Same thing. It's just that when you are out of equilibrium and you have put a voltage, you might have two different chemical potentials. We'll call that mu 1 and mu 2. Okay. So the idea is, the way you think about current flow and all this, is that There is a set of states that are filled and a set of states that are empty. And then you have a chemical potential which separates them. Okay. Now, how does current flow? The idea is that when you put a voltage across this, what is happening is you've got two contacts. And the contacts also have a very large density of states. These are big regions with lots of states. So I'll just draw it as lots of states here, which are filled up to some point, which you call mu 1. And the right-hand side, that's the other contact, that also has a set of states which are filled up to some point, which I'll call mu 2. So these are the two chemical potentials and the two contacts, and they are separated a little bit. Why are they separated? Well, because that's what this battery does. It applies this potential so that everything in the drain is kind of lowered with respect to the source. Why is it lowered? Well, because I'm assuming there's a positive voltage there. A positive voltage lowers all the electron energies, because these are what are called electron energy diagrams. So anytime you put a positive potential somewhere, you make it easier for electrons to get there, and so you lower it. Okay. So I guess I'll just draw it a little bit lower so you can see it clearly. So this amount by which it is lowered, that's what I'll call that's the drain voltage. That's the amount by which it's lowered. That's it. Now, will this conduct? And the answer is that it will conduct if you have states in here. If you do not have any states in here, it won't conduct. That's it. So zero order, if you want to know how big is the conductance, it depends on the density of states. But then density of states is, of course, a function of energy. Now, at some energies, you might have a lot. At some other energies, you might have few. But what matters is the density of states right around the chemical potential, right around, you know, the place up to which it is normally filled. It doesn't matter how much density of states you have down here. It doesn't matter how much density of states you have way up there. What matters is what's right here. And why is that? Well, you can kind of see it from a common sense point of view. The way it works is this. Why does current flow? Well, it's like this contact would like to bring this channel into equilibrium with itself. And coming into equilibrium means having the same chemical potential. You know, just like heat wants to flow so as to make the temperatures equal. Similarly, electrons want to flow so as to fill it up to here. So if this thing were in equilibrium with this, it would want to be filled up to here. So that, you know, these are all filled, these would kind of spill over and fill it. That's what it would want to do. On the other hand, this contact, because its chemical potential is here, it really wants to keep these states empty. So what happens is, this contact keeps filling it up with electrons, and then this one keeps pulling them out. And so electrons keep coming in from here and keep getting pulled out over there. Now, of course, once it gets pulled out, it would get negatively charged, but then it flows out into the battery. And the electron that came in from here, that gets replenished from the battery again. And so a current flows in the external circuit. And this just goes on forever. That's it. So basically, why does current flow then? Well, because there are these states. One contact wants to fill it up. One contact wants to empty it. And so current keeps flowing. Okay. So that immediately tells you why these states don't matter. You know, because the question I said was, you know, every insulator has zillions of electrons. Why doesn't it conduct? Well, because the insulator, it has zillions of electrons, but all those states are somewhere down here. They're not where your chemical potential is. They don't have any states here. It's all the way down here. And if it's down here, it doesn't help. Why? Because, you see, this contact wants to fill them up because it's below mu 1. Now, this contact also wants to fill them up because it's below mu 2. And so they're all filled. I mean, that's it. And then no current flows because they just stay filled. Nothing else happens. That's all. But this is the thing that you see often raises a lot of questions. You know, it looks pretty obvious when you think of it that way. But this is the thing that raises lots of questions. You know, people say, well, no, you know, current flows because of an electric field. And if I put an electric field, all the electrons should start moving. And the thing is, that's wrong, really. I mean, that's pretty clearly established. That's not what happens. Which is why, again, an insulator, although it has zillions of electrons, doesn't really conduct. Okay. So in order to conduct, then, the most important thing is have a density of states around the chemical potential, number one. The other thing that matters, as you might have guessed, is how easily electrons can come in and out. Because, as I said, this contact wants to fill it up, but then if there's a big barrier here so that electrons cannot come in easily, you know, let's say there was a little gap, your contact isn't very good, well, then you would expect the current to go down. So basically, as you might have expected, just from common sense, that what does conductance depend on? Well, it depends on how many states you have around your chemical potential and how easily electrons can get in and out. And that's what this one is. This is a measure of how easily electrons get in and out. In fact, the way I'll define it is, we define this gamma with the dimensions of energy. So that gamma divided by h bar has the dimensions of per second. As you know, energy divided by h. And by the way, h bar is h over 2 pi. Let me just remind you. Where this is the Planck's constant, and often it appears in this form, and so you write it this way. And h, as you know, has the dimensions of joule second. And so when you take energy, which is in joules, and divide it by h bar, you get per second. So this gamma over h bar, it tells you the rate per second at which electrons would want to come in or go out. So that's this gamma. So d is the density of states per unit energy. Gamma is this rate. And so when you multiply the two, it's a dimensionless number. This is electron volts. This is electron volts. This is per electron volt. Dimensionless number. So conductance is this quantum of conductance times that number. So this would be the... Now, this equation, of course, is not meant to be obvious. That's what we'll be discussing in next day. Actually, yeah, next day I'll explain where this came from. Right now, I was just trying to tell you that how this bottom-up view helps you understand the conductance of not only small things, but also large things. That's what I'm trying to get across. Now, so this density of states then at the Fermi energy or at the chemical potential, that is a very important thing in order to understand whether something conducts or not. That's the first thing you need to know. So, now, how do you know these density of states? Now, experimentally, the way you measure them, and that's a very important thing because, as I said, in this business, you know, good experiments are extremely important in terms of providing a reality check for how you think about things. So, as I said, we think about materials as having a set of energy levels that are filled and a set of energy levels that are empty. Now, how do you measure these levels? And the answer is, I guess the most common method would be the photoelectric effect. What's that? You hit it with light, change the energy of light with which you are hitting it, and you look at how many electrons are knocked out of the solid. So you have a piece of solid, you're hitting it with light, looking at the electrons that come out. And if h nu is small, no electrons will come out. But once you get to high enough frequencies, so that the h nu is, say, 5 or 6 volts, and that's actually beyond the visible spectrum. Okay? So once the energy, this h nu is, say, 6 volts, 7 volts, then what happens is electrons get knocked out. This is this famous photoelectric effect. And what you can see is, so these energies are actually all considered negative in the sense that any electron, let's say if it were outside here, you call its energy zero, then being inside the solid has negative energy, which is why it stays inside. It goes to the lowest energy, stays inside. But then if you hit it with light, you can kick it out into the vacuum. So people call this the vacuum level. So what that means is the energy it would have it was if it was outside. And these are all negative numbers. So typically in any solid, that would be like 5 or 6 volts negative. How do I know where it is? Well, if you hit it with a photon whose energy is 6 volts, it could knock it out. Light would, it would come out. Now, it's a little harder to measure the empty states. Why? Because, you know, there's nothing there to knock out. These, you know, there's electrons in there, so you can knock it out. Okay. So here, one experiment you could do, one people do is something called the inverse photoemission, which is where you shine electrons on it. And when the electrons drop into the solid, they emit light. And you look at what comes out. But that's a harder experiment to do, actually. Often people just do optical absorption, which means you shine light and excite electrons from here to there. And you see what energies are getting absorbed. Analyze all that and try to come out with the density of states. Anyway, so this is the kind of experiments that people have done, you know, over the last 70, 80 years on all kinds of materials and developed a pretty good catalog of understanding of where these levels are in different materials. But in order to understand conduction through anything then, that's like the first thing you really need to know. What's the density of states looks like? And, you know, where is the chemical potential? Because you really need the density of states at the chemical potential in order to understand current flow. There's all kinds of properties of the solid for which you need to understand the details of everything down here also. You know, things like what is the bonding strength, what is the melting point, what are the mechanical properties, all that will involve all the electrons. But as far as current flow goes, what matters is the levels right around the chemical potential. Because current flow is about an electron coming in and going out. And so the important things are this D and the gamma. The gamma meaning, which tells you how good are your contacts, how easily do they come in and out. Okay. Now you might say, well, okay, so this bottom-up view, maybe it works well for something small, but how would you apply it to something big? You know, after all, when you get to big things, you expect the conductance to be A over L. And this is what I guess we'll be doing properly in the next few lectures, the next day. But just to give you an idea of how this works, it's something like this. That when you get to a big thing, the density of states is proportional to the volume of the solid. That is, if you make something twice as big, you'll have twice as many energies in energy levels in the same energy range. Make it thrice as big, there'll be three times as many. So in big things, the density of states goes as the area times the length. Okay. Now, what's this gamma? That's like tells you, if I put an electron inside the channel, how easily does it get out? Now, once you have something relatively long, you might say that, well, the length, time it takes to get out depends on how long this channel is, because it has to get through the channel. And so gamma actually becomes proportional to 1 over the length. The longer you make it, you know, the longer it takes to get out. And so per second, that gamma gets smaller. Now, in that case, you see that the conductance, the L cancels, and the conductance becomes proportional to the area, but is independent of length. And that's exactly what a ballistic conductor kind of behaves like. Ballistic means people have been making measurements on relatively small conductors where electrons can go straight through. And the resistance they measure then depends on the cross-sectional area. You make it bigger this way, you get more electrons through it. But it's independent of length. You make it twice as big, it's still about the same resistance. You see? And that's kind of, you can understand it by saying D is proportional to AL, but the gamma is proportional to 1 over L. Okay. But then when you get to really long conductors and electrons are actually getting knocked around all over the place, then what you can show is that in a diffusive transport like that, the time it takes to get out of the channel is not proportional to L, but actually L square. That is, when you go straight through ballistically, the time it takes you to get through a region of length L is 1 over L. But when you are going around like this drunken guy, etc., the time it takes you is really more proportional to 1 over L square. That comes from the diffusion equation. Those are things we'll be discussing properly. And the point is that if it's 1 over L square, then you can see AL, 1 over L square, and now you get Ohm's law. So this would be the, I'd say, the in a one line, the bottom-up view of how to understand conductance. What is the conductance of something really small? Is this quantum of conductance times d times gamma. D is the density of states. If you have lots of states around the chemical potential, it conducts well. What's gamma? It just tells you how easily the electrons get in and out of the contact. Make it a little longer. Gamma depends also on the length of the channel, because the electrons have to get through the channel. That's 1 over L. And then if the transport is diffusive, it becomes 1 over L square. So that's how you go from what I'd call molecular transport to ballistic transport to diffusive transport. And it gives you a nice clean picture. Okay. So what we'll be doing in this course then, I guess next day I'll give you a rough outline of how we'll be going through this course. And so let me stop here today since we're out of time and do it. Carry on.